Welcome. We're so glad that you've decided to join us. We're doing a series of 13, actually, on the background characters of the Old Testament. Now, almost everybody knows about the great heroes of the Old Testament, and we can talk about Moses, and we can talk about Noah, and we can talk about David, and so forth. But this series, we're going to talk about some of the lesser-known characters, so you might want to get out your Bible. We're going to start out, and most of this particular series of lessons is going to be on Numbers 13 and 14, Joshua 14, and Judges 1, if you want to just get a little heads up on what's going to go on. But before we open our Bible, let's begin with a word of prayer. Our loving and wonderful Father, we've come once again to look at your word, to discuss what it should mean to us, to understand what some of these less important, less well-known stories should mean. We want to understand not only the story and in its context, but we want to understand the larger setting of the great controversy and how you were doing things which need to be done and all that the devil is trying to do to put roadblocks in your way. May these stories draw us nearer to you is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
This particular lesson is about Caleb. It was entitled, Caleb Living with the Weight. And where is the first time we hear about Caleb in the Bible? Anyone know offhand?
Numbers 13.
Numbers 13. And to just sort of introduce that, I have an interesting question here in my handout. This series of lessons is about background characters. Can you tell me what the following important background characters did? Shemuel, Shaphat, Egal, Palti, Gadiel, Gadi, Amiel, Sether, Nabi, and Jeul.
No.
No.
Don't know what they did. Did they do it all together?
What?
Were they all together? Or
they were all together.
The spies
along with a couple others.
Well, what if I told you that they were associated with Caleb and Joshua?
Then you'd know.
Then you'd know.
Yeah.
Very interesting point. So, in this case, it's the Caleb and the Joshuas that we want to talk about.
Okay, so the others were the spies that went with Caleb and Joshua.
On that 40-day trip into the land and came back with a bad report.
Okay.
Told them there were giants in the land.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're also going to talk a little bit about Caleb's nephew, a gentleman by the name of Othniel. They were both fairly important players in the history of the early history of the children of Israel in the land of Canaan. Well, how do you explain Numbers 13, 1 and 2? Let's read that first. The Lord said to Moses, notice carefully, the Lord said to Moses, choose one of the leaders from each of the 12 tribes and send them as spies to explore the land of Canaan, which I'm giving the Israelites. Now notice, these were tribal leaders. These aren't just ordinary people. They're leaders of thousands of people, okay, each one of them. Okay. So what did it say? How did this happen? What was the word? The Lord said to Moses?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, look at Deuteronomy 1, verses 19 to 22. Deuteronomy 1, 19 to 22. Now this is Moses recounting later, just before the children of Israel went into the land of Canaan, recounting what had happened in that earlier experience. He says, we did what the Lord our God commanded us. We left Mount Sinai and went through that vast and fearful desert on the way to the hill country of the Amorites. When we reached Kadesh Barnea, I said, you have now come to the hill country of the Amorites, which the Lord our God, the God of our ancestors, is giving us. Look, there it is. Go and occupy it as he commanded. Do not hesitate or be afraid. So did Moses seem to have any questions about their capacity to move in and conquer the land?
No.
He was not confident.
But you came to me, this is Moses speaking now, you came to me and said, let's send men ahead of us to spy out the land so that they can tell us the best route to take and what kind of cities are there. That seemed a good thing to do, so I selected 12 men, one from each tribe. They went into the hill country as far as the Valley of Eshkol, etc. So how did the story really take place? Did God command them to choose spies, or did they want to choose the spies?
Hmm.
somewhere in here, the impression I get is that somebody was getting a little shaky on their faith. I think Moses had it, but you contrast that again in a military operation. Even today, if you're going to take some land, you send somebody in, a spy. It's a kind of a mix here I've often wondered about.
Two different writers here, though. You have two different redactors putting these two stories together, or making two accounts of the same instance.
So who wrote the book? Both by Moses.
According to the traditional, these books are written by Moses.
Yeah. I understand that, but now, they're two, just like we got two Genesis accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, two beginning
creation
accounts mm-hmm. in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. So we've got two accounts of this situation here, one in
so
Numbers
you
and
think
one
that maybe these different stories came in because people were doing later editing.
I don't see how you can help it, because Ezra did edit most of a good chunk of the Old Testament, didn't he?
That's possible.
Do you think that when God saw that the people were insecure, then God told Moses, well, okay, pick out the spies and let's do it that way?
How I view it is this. The Israelites have had the cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night, leading them everywhere that they are to go. They've had manna every day.
Mm-hmm.
They still have manna here.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to ask, we need more. That's mm-hmm. what they were saying. We don't trust you, God. We need more. We need to send our own people in to look.
Give us some evidence.
Yeah.
That's right.
We don't have enough evidence.
Yeah.
That you're leading us.
You're leading us, right.
We need something else. And so when the people said, we need some more evidence, God said, and Moses said, and God said, okay, if you need more evidence, go ahead, send the spies.
Mm-hmm.
Does the Greek say that Peterson puts that when he said, let's send some men ahead to scout out the land for us and bring back a report of the best route to take and the kinds of towns we can expect to find. That seemed like a good idea to me, so we picked 12 men, each one.
Mm-hmm.
What does the Greek support?
Well, it's the Hebrew in this case.
The Hebrew, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's pretty close. That other translation, my translation, says more or less
that
the same
thing. That seemed like a good idea to me.
Mm-hmm.
Moses, remember, was a trained general from the Egyptian times.
Sure.
So, you know, he knew about this scouting out the land to figure out what route to take and what our obstacles are.
Well,
is
there any evidence that God didn't like that idea?
Well,
yes, further down it said that's when he said, you're not going in, some of you are going to die.
Well, that was because of a different situation. This is before that.
Yeah, but of course, you're asking the question, does God have foreknowledge? Does he know?
No, I'm saying, is there any evidence in here that said that God didn't like the idea of sending spies in?
Oh, did he let him know that? You're asking if God, did God let Moses know that?
Yeah.
There's no evidence in the scripture of that.
No.
A parallel about, Moses' early writings compared to the earlier writings is found in Exodus 20, verses 8 to 11. Very famous verse that Seventh-day Adventists particularly know. Observe the Sabbath and keep it holy. You have 6 days in which to do your work, but the seventh day is a day of rest dedicated to me. On that day, no one is to work, neither you nor your children, your slaves, your animals, nor the foreigners who live in the country. In 6 days, now he's going to give the reason, in 6 days I, the Lord, made the earth, the sea, and the sky and the sea, and everything in them. But on the seventh day I rested. That is why I, the Lord, blessed the Sabbath and made it holy. But if we look back later when Moses reports on all this in Deuteronomy 5, starting with verse 12, it says this. Observe the Sabbath and keep it holy, as I, the Lord your God, have commanded you. You have 6 days in which to do your work, but the seventh day is a day of rest dedicated to me. On that day, no one is to work, neither you, your children, your slaves, your animals, nor the foreigners who live in your country. Your slaves must rest just as you do. Remember that. I'm the one who created the earth? No, I'm the one that you were slaves in Egypt, and that I, the Lord your God, rescued you by my great power and strength. That is why I command you to observe the Sabbath.
But in the read Exodus 20 and start with verse 1.
Go ahead. Read the first couple of verses.
God spoke all these words. I am God, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of a life of slavery. No other gods, only me. And then starts the Ten Commandments that we read. Mm-hmm. But in that same thought process, the whole notion of Egypt was there in Exodus as well as in Deuteronomy.
Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing is that if you asked most of us today, well, which were the real Ten Commandments, we would say Exodus 20. But it's interesting that in Deuteronomy 5, in verse 22, it says, these are the commands that the Lord gave to all of you when you were gathered at the mountain. When he spoke with a mighty voice from the fire and from the thick clouds, he gave these commands and no others. Then he wrote them on two tables of stones and gave them to me.
If you brought these two versions to Moses, would he said, you know, I must have made a mistake on one of those?
No.
Well, then why are we? What's
well,
the issue?
You look at that. You look at the those two accounts. They're all identical except for the fourth commandment.
The reason, yeah.
It's almost like whatever the fourth commandment is, that either creation or getting out of Egypt is kind of a wrapper around something that's more important inside of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to kind
God.
Of figure out what that is. It could be, you know, it's number seven is a finished thing. You get out of Egypt, that was a finished thing. You finished creation, that was finished. When something's finished, you have a Sabbath over
mm-hmm.
to think about it, to see whether it's good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things that you can take out of that.
Well, coming back to our story about the spies, because we're talking about Caleb now, after a little detour. If you had been one of those 12 spies moving through the land, and presumably they could no longer take, they didn't take any manna with them, did they? We don't have any evidence that they carried any manna with us. They'd been eating manna for more than a year.
It was a fruitful land. They were eating off the land.
Yeah, probably. What would you want to try first?
Mangoes. I decided whether the country was worth it or not, whether the kind of mangoes they had.
Okay. Very good.
I'd stick with the
bad.
Grapes.
You stick with the grapes?
Grapes and pomegranates and figs that we read about.
It says milk and honey.
Yeah, it's...
I guess I'd have gone hungry, huh?
It's interesting, if you travel to Israel today, there's a symbol they use for the whole tourist industry. Anywhere there's anything to do with tourists, there's a symbol. Can you guess what the symbol is?
Bunch of grapes, isn't it?
Two men with a stick carrying a bunch of grapes.
Yeah. Oh. So these are the two men we are studying.
Yes. Well, we don't know exactly which two men. They probably traded off. But, yes, two men with this long pole between their shoulders carrying a bunch of grapes.
Carrying big grapes.
Yes.
Okay. Each grape's the size of a cantaloupe.
Well, and that raises the next question. Was this this bunch of grapes really so big that it required two men to carry it? Or was it so full of grapes that that was the only way they could carry it without messing it up?
Either way. Grapes are rather heavy.
Either way, you end up with grapes on a pole.
Okay.
And a grape is one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Little or big.
Well, if you look at the picture that's connected with our Bible study guide, it looks like there's other fruits on that pole besides just grapes.
Oh.
I don't know about that. Well,
the text says pomegranates and figs as well as,
mm-hmm.
as well as the grapes.
Yeah, okay.
See, where is that?
Sounding like a good
verse 23.
Yeah.
And it does say they cut off a branch that had one bunch of grapes on it, so heavy that it took two men to carry it on a pole between them. That's verse 23 also.
Okay, now I'm going to go to verse 25, and here's where the real issues start. After exploring the land for 40 days, I'm again reading from my Good News Bible, the spies returned to Moses, Aaron, and the whole community of Israel at Kadesh, in the wilderness of Paran. They reported what they had seen and showed them the fruit they had brought. So what would you think if you nobody had said anything yet, and here you look at these grapes and pomegranates and figs, you said, right? Grapes and pomegranates and figs. I mean, you take one look at that, and what would you say?
Let's go.
Exactly.
Grab somebody.
They said to well, the spies reported on what they had seen and showed them the fruit they had brought. They said to Moses, "We explored the land and found it to be rich and fertile, and here are some of its fruit." Okay? So, no contradiction in the report so far, right? "But the people who live there are powerful, and their cities are very large and well fortified. Even worse, we saw the descendants of the giants there. Amalekites live in the southern part of the land. Hittites, by the way, had the Israelites already beaten the Amalekites in one battle?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hittites and Jebusites and Amorites live in the hill country, and Canaanites live by the Mediterranean Sea along the River Jordan." Caleb silenced the people who were complaining against Moses and said, "We should attack now and take the land. We are strong enough to conquer it." And what is their response to Caleb? Caleb's own study. "But the men who had gone with Caleb said, 'No, we are not strong enough to attack them. The people there are more powerful than we are.'" Now, they said they're rich, they live in a fertile land, they're giants, so it all fits together, right? So they spread a false rumor among the Israelites about the land they had explored. They said, now notice this part of the report, "That land doesn't even produce enough to feed the people who live there. Everyone we saw was very tall. Would they be very tall if it didn't produce enough food to feed the people who were living there? And we even saw giants there, the descendants of Anak. We feel as small as grasshoppers, and this is how we must have looked to them."
So they sort of lied?
Misrepresented.
Misrepresented?
Cold feet. This is what I was getting at earlier. They turn it all around.
Now, Caleb was not an Israelite, isn't that right?
Caleb was. Well, Caleb was one of the heads of the tribe of Judah. It's the Kenizzites, Hobab, Moses' brother-in-law. It wasn't a...
They had been wanting to go back to Egypt for a long time.
Well, they've only been out of Egypt for a year and a half so far.
Yeah, and so they're getting tired of this. And so they bring a backstory so they can say, let's pick another leader and let's go back to Egypt.
Well,
so
all
this is the go back to Egypt versus this go ahead group.
Okay. All they've done so far is escaped, walked to the Red Sea, traveled down to the foot of Mount Sinai, listened to God, received His commandments, built the tabernacle, and headed for Israel. Headed for Canaan.
But they still wanted to go back to Egypt.
They weren't afraid of that pillar of fire at night and the cloud during the day and the manna. They were not thinking of God.
They had memories as long as a gnat.
It didn't take them long.
They're used to that.
That's not a big deal.
The next verses of 14. "The whole communion was in uproar, wailing all night long. All the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The entire community was in on it. Why didn't we die in Egypt? Or is this the wilderness? Or in this wilderness? Why has God brought us in this country to kill us? Our wives and children are about to become plunder. Why don't we just head back to Egypt right now?"
Well, it's kind of like it's the opposite of faith. Doubt has
taken
gone over them instead of faith to, you know, to get the power to go forward. The opposite happened to them, and it was like it pushed them back into it was unreasonable.
Tools did they have after being in Egypt for the number of years they had, other than, you know, cloud and what I mean?
You worship a God who just demolished the land of Egypt.
Yeah.
True.
And the Egyptian army.
Plus he
and took
it into water and he
wonderful
make
things
that
have
mountain
happened.
Shake.
But what tools do they have to make that?
Well, see, that's
their
the problem.
Strength.
You see, if you think that you've got to do it with the tools you have in your hand, that's a problem. If you ask, can God do this with the tools He has in His hands? That's a different story completely.
Okay. But you have to have some sort of background in your experience. I mean, everything that we read in here comes from our own experience. I mean, we read it and we apply it to our life because of our experience. What experience did they have other than these miracles that happened?
There were a lot of miracles.
Every day there were miracles.
All the plagues of Egypt, the Red Sea, the
Mount
fire
Sinai.
On Mount Sinai, the thunder on Mount Sinai.
Manna every
God's manna again.
Yeah, God couldn't have given them a whole lot more, but I mean.
Other than all these miracles, what more do you have, huh?
Well, notice what. Show that you can forget all those.
I mean, it raises questions. If you look at the Bible, there were really, depending on how you divide things up, I guess. Anyway, let's just say this. This is one of the great miracle working times of the Bible. No question about that. And was it a time of great faith? You know, today we hear people saying, well, if God would just do this and this and this, if God would just do what I think he should do, we would have more miracles, and boy, people would have so much faith, they would just march into the kingdom, right?
But you're one of those people there. You're used to these miracles. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what's going on here. You send 12 people up there, and 10 of them come back and say, you better not do it, and 2 of them say, you should. Don't you go with the majority?
Well, look what happened. Reading on from verse 5 of chapter 14. Then Moses and Aaron bowed to the ground in front of all the people. And Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, 2 of the spies, these are our heroes, tore their clothes in sorrow and said to the people, the land we explored is an excellent land. If the Lord is pleased with us, notice this very important caveat, if the Lord is pleased with us, he will take us there and give us that rich and fertile land. Not we can fight our way into the land,
no.
Or do we have enough swords here, but the Lord will do it. Do not rebel against the Lord, and don't be afraid of the people who live there. We will conquer them easily. The Lord is with us and has defeated the gods who protected them, so don't be afraid. The whole community was threatening to stone them to death, but suddenly the people saw the dazzling light of the Lord's presence appear over the tent. Try to imagine this situation. What would you do?
Yeah, 2 out of how many? And then God presents himself.
Yeah, the glory of God. And all of a sudden, woo, there it is.
Yeah.
And everybody's, hold on here a bit, you know.
Yeah. Maybe we rethink this.
Yeah. Well, notice what happens next. This is very significant. The Lord said to Moses, how much longer will these people reject me? How much longer will they refuse to trust in me? Even though I have performed so many miracles. This is what we were just talking about. I perform so many miracles among them. I will send an epidemic and destroy them, but I will make you the father of a nation that is larger and more powerful than they are. Have we ever heard that kind of argument before?
At Sinai.
At Sinai, when they were dancing around the golden calf. The same argument. What's going on here between Moses and God?
Are you reading verse 13?
I just read 12.
12, okay.
So God is always saying, I might as well wipe out these Jews and start a race from you, Moses, just like I did with Noah.
Or Abraham. But Moses said to the Lord, and notice Moses' thinking here, you brought these people out of Egypt by your power. When the Egyptians hear what you have done to your people, they will tell it to the people who live in this land. These people have already heard that you, Lord, are with us, that you are plainly seen when your cloud stops over us, and that you go before us in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Okay, had all the nations around heard about what was going on with the children of Israel?
Yes.
Yep, that's what he's suggesting here. Now, if you kill all your people, the nations who have heard of your fame will say that you killed your people in the wilderness because you... Notice the people were afraid to go in because we're not sure we can conquer the land, right? And Moses says, we can't go in unless who does what? He says, God, you're the one who can do it. See? So now, Lord, I pray, show us your power and do what you promised when you said, I, the Lord, am not easily angered. And I show great love and faithfulness and forgive you sin and rebellion. Yet I will not fail to punish children and the grandchildren to the third and fourth generation for the sins of their parents. And now, Lord, according to the greatness of your unchanging love, forgive, excuse me, I pray the sin of these people, just as you have forgiven them ever since they left Egypt.
What a leader Moses is.
What a conversation between Moses and God. What does it teach us about, and why, even if this happened, why would Moses write it down? Is Moses bragging?
No.
Moses is giving a glimpse of God's character that Moses had learned and is trying to tell this story so that we would understand God's character?
I suspect that God and the devil had a conversation about Moses shortly before this, just as they did in Job 1 and 2 about Job. And God said, "Have you seen my servant Moses down there? He's got it together."
And I suspect that Satan would be having a conversation about all the children of Israel just about that point.
Yeah.
These people
play the numbers game, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Well, does God change his mind when we plead with him? Look at 1 Samuel 15. I'm going to read first in verses 10 and 11. And this.
Why not just the next verse?
We'll get back there.
Okay.
The Lord said to Samuel, "I am sorry that I made Saul king. He has turned." I'm looking at 1 Samuel 15, verse 10. "I am sorry that I made Saul king. He has turned away from me and disappointed my commands." Samuel was angry and pleaded all night. They pleaded with the Lord, etc., etc. Well, we go down a little bit later in that same chapter to verse 29. And notice what it says. I get my screen down there. "Israel's majestic God does not lie or change his mind. He is not a human being. He does not change his mind." Yes or no? I'm sorry that I made Saul king. I don't change my mind, right?
That's a puzzle.
And then verse 35, "As long as Samuel lived, he never again saw the king, but he grieved over him. The Lord was sorry that he had made Saul king of Israel."
I think the Lord was sorry that the people insisted that there be a king like Saul, and he was sorry that he had to choose a king like Saul.
Well, does sorry always mean it's the wrong thing?
You tell me.
RSV says he repented that he had...
Repented. That's what the original language says.
Huh? Did God repent?
Changed his mind. Changed course.
Does, when you say I'm sorry, does that mean you changed your mind?
Well, what about this verse? Malachi 3, verse 6. Malachi 3, verse 6. "I am the Lord, and I do not change."
Well, I've had parents sorry that they gave somebody a spanking, and they weren't going to change whether they were going to give them a spanking or not. But they said they were sorry that they had to give it.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well,
you deserve
it's a
it.
Bad,
I'm sorry, I have to
it's
give
a
it.
It's a bad situation. I'm sorry about it, but but you've got to go through it. I mean.
It shows God has emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that he cares about the people he's dealing with. I suspect that these two stories, the one in Exodus 32 and this one here in Numbers 14, were recorded partly because of the fact that I don't think anybody else in the universe knew it yet, but God knew that he was preparing within a few years to bring Moses straight to heaven. And he wanted the people up there to know what kind of a character this was.
Mm.
Because Moses had already was a murderer, wasn't he?
Yes.
And he'd been trained as a general in the Israelite army. He'd been trained in all the mysticism and all the religious fakery and so forth in Egypt. They thought he was going to be the next Pharaoh. So God says, "You people need to see this. Look what kind of person this man really is." And I think these two experiences tell us marvelous things about Moses. They tell us marvelous things about how God does his business. He doesn't just say, "I'm taking Moses to heaven. I don't care whether you people like it or not." He gives, here's two demonstrations of why it's safe to have Moses in heaven. Okay, Norm, you want to go on to the next verse?
Sure. Let me read verse 19.
You're reading...
This is the Peterson's...
Numbers 14.
Numbers 14, starting with verse 19. Please forgive the wrongdoings of this people out of the extravagance of your loyal love, just as all along, from the time they left Egypt, you have been forgiving this people. God said, I forgive them, honoring your words. Mm-hmm. But as I live, as the glory of God fills the whole earth, not a single person of those who saw my glory saw the miracle signs I did in Egypt and the wilderness and who have tested me over and over and over again, turning a deaf ear to me. Not one of them will set eyes on the land.
Okay.
Now, in this process, it looks like God says, I'm going to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Moses intervenes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Moses, as he spoke this and as he prayed this, got stronger and stronger and stronger in his conviction, and the logic was better and better and better?
Okay.
And he was changed, and God said, I can do this because this man has a new attitude.
Mm-hmm. Well,
or his attitude has grown.
Yes. Or is God saying, I know there's a problem with a bunch of people. They're not prepared to go in the land. They're not prepared to let me take them into the land.
Right.
But the leader is a different kind of a person completely. And here's the proof of it.
Does this also show that earnest prayer and intervening for others and selfless prayer will cause God to answer?
But answer what?
The question is why.
God,
obviously it does, but why?
God likes to see these kinds of people here on earth because that's what is when he can take them to heaven, is when you're selfless and you can pray for others.
Okay, well, let's read on. I'll go back to my version. They will never enter the land which I promised to their ancestors. None of those who have rejected me will ever enter it. But because my servant Caleb, and that's our man we're really focusing on today, mm-hmm. has a different attitude and has remained loyal to me, I will bring him into the land which he explored, and his descendants will possess the land, in whose valleys the Amalekites and the Canaanites now live. Turn back tomorrow and go into the wilderness in the direction of the Gulf of Aqaba. And what happened?
40 years.
Well, not only that, a couple things happened first. So when God said, turn back, what do they say? Oh, no, we're not going to turn back. We can do this. And so God said, go in. They said, no. God said, go back. They said, no. God said, go in. He said, no. It didn't matter what God said. They always were against it. So here's the next question. Well, how many people did you say were going to die, according to your translation there?
It says not one.
Mm-hmm. How many are left if not one is going to be taken in?
Not very many.
Not very many. We know that the group that went in, if we look at the count at the end of Numbers, was just about the same as the ones he would counted back at the beginning of Numbers. So how do we explain that?
Well, it was their children that went in.
But how do you have children if none of you are around?
Well, they had 40 years.
40 years, okay.
It was the children that were born in the wilderness when they, after 40 years, the children marched in.
Well,
so these are all youngsters.
The children got there at the edge of the land again, did they just say, okay, now this time we're going to go across and not make the mistake our parents did?
No, unfortunately.
Yeah. Look at verse 29. Maybe it'll spell it out for us a little
bit.
Numbers 14, 29. You will die and your corpses will be scattered across the wilderness. I mean, God just makes it very graphic. Because you have complained against me, none of you over 20 years of age will enter that land. So who is that now?
This says 20 years of age. Who was counted in the census?
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of it?
Because that's what they had just done, the census.
That's how they decided.
Yeah.
So the census was men.
So the census included men of military capacity, which would be men over the age of 20. Only the men were counted.
Okay.
So that raises the next question. Did all the women over 20 die too?
We don't know.
He said all
that were counted in the census.
Well, but the people died that were in rebellion. Were the women rebelling along with their husbands?
Probably.
You bet.
It didn't say I'm going to kill all the men. It says the rebellious
people. They're going to die there. It didn't say you're going to kill them.
Do we know of anybody who survived other than Caleb and Joshua?
Well, was probably those that were under 20.
Well, first of all, before we go too far, let's look at a couple of other verses. Look at Numbers 3, verse 15. Go back to the early part of the book.
3:13?
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, 15. 3:15.
I would be very happy if I was 20 years old and had not had my 21st birthday when people got God mad.
Okay. In the Sinai Desert, the Lord commanded Moses to register the Levites by clans and families. Now, he's already talked about registering everybody else, and he counted them starting from age 20. Okay, but now he's going to the tribe of Levi, enrolling every male a month old or older. Why is he counting the Levites starting from 1 month of age? Furthermore, and I don't have time to go to all the other verses, but we know that whereas the military people would go off to war at age 20, the Levites did not serve in the tabernacle until age 30. So would you say then that the Levites, well, first of all, did any of the Levites die in this general
death? Did they rebel?
Well, I'm asking you.
Don't know.
We don't know.
It seems like they did.
Do we know of any Levites who survived?
Yeah, there was one.
Do you know of one?
Well, look at Joshua 17:24. Mm-hmm. Joshua, I'm sorry, 17:4. Then went Eleazar the priest. They went to Eleazar the priest and to Joshua son of Nun and to the leaders and said, "The Lord commanded us." Who's Eleazar the priest?
Is he a Levite?
He was a Levite. He was the son of Aaron. And he was already a mature priest back at Sinai.
He was over 20.
Yes, definitely over 20. And here he is, he's still in the land of Canaan. If we go to the very end of the book of Joshua, what do we find there? Look at Joshua 24:33. Eleazar, son of Aaron, died and was buried at Gibeah, the town in the hill country of Ephraim, which had been given to his son Phinehas. So at least one of the Levites survived. So it wasn't just Caleb and Joshua. So is God being partial here?
Well, I'm a little confused. I'm having a hard time following the sequence. But in 30 it says, "I promised to let you live there, but not one of you will."
Which chapter are you?
In 14:30.
Okay, Numbers 14:30.
Except for Caleb and Joshua. Now, who is he talking to? Because he's not talking directly to Caleb and Joshua.
Well, he's speaking through Moses to all the people.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it seems to suggest that the only ones who are going to survive are Caleb and Joshua. Now, the next question, of course, I would ask is, what about Caleb's wife and Joshua's wife?
Well, didn't they usually refer to a family by the
father's name?
Yeah. So well, I would assume it would be the family.
By the time we get into the land of Canaan, Caleb and Joshua are going to be like 20 years older than anybody else around, at least.
They'll have children.
Except Eleazar.
Except Eleazar. And maybe some of the other Levites. This question's to stir up your pure minds here. Well, think about Caleb's story. Caleb and the rest of the Israelites had grown up in Egypt, where they were continually told that the Egyptian gods were superior to their Israelite gods, or Israelite God, because their God couldn't even get them out of slavery. So imagine, you know, Caleb grew up with that for 40 years. When Caleb was 40 years of age, Moses returned from herding sheep in the wilderness, and that, of course, is the story of Moses, and suddenly everything changed. Caleb lived through the 10 plagues of Egypt. He sprinkled his door with the blood of the Passover. He prepared the Passover meal with his wife. He and his family walked down along the Red Sea and in that frightful experience at nighttime, crossed the Red Sea on dry land. He was there at the foot of Mount Sinai through the incredible experiences of God giving the Ten Commandments and the rest of his instructions from the Mount. No doubt he assisted in bringing together supplies, etc., for the building of the tabernacle. These are all stories that are documented in Scripture. When the construction of the tabernacle was completed, they followed the cloud and set out straight for the promised land. Everything looked so promising, it was no more than 2 or 3 weeks' journey from Sinai to Palestine. Then he was chosen as one of the 12 spies. After the terrible rebellion at Kadesh Barnea, through no fault of his own and against his advice urged upon the people, he was forced to go with them back into the wilderness to wander for 40 years in the desert sands. During those 40 years, he watched every one of his peers die except Joshua. The 10 leaders of the tribe who had been chosen to be spies and who had turned against the Lord and were unfaithful, what happened to them? Look at verses,
Say they died.
Look at verses 36 to 38. The men Moses had sent to explore the land brought back a false report which caused the people to complain against the Lord. And so the Lord struck them with a disease, and they died. Of the 12 spies, only Joshua and Caleb survived.
So in this land where they didn't have the same immunity, they probably picked up a disease as they were spying and died of that disease.
They probably carried it back to their families, too.
Yep.
Why didn't Caleb and Joshua carry it back to their families?
They were miraculously saved.
And, well, what if they decided to go forward? Then all of Israel would get that disease.
God would have protected them, just like he did from the snakes.
Okay.
Well, just before entering the land, while Moses was still alive, Caleb, among others, was asked to be on the committee to choose the fairest way to divide up the land. Now, if you stop and think about it, who of all the children of Israel had been into the land to look it over?
He had.
Who?
Caleb.
Caleb and Joshua. They were the only two guys. Now, if here we are, there's nine of us around the table here, I guess eight of us. If 12 of us, if there were four more here, and we were chosen as a committee to divide up the land of Palestine, and none of us had ever been there, we would say we're all more or less equal. But if a couple of us had been there and they really looked the place over and checked it all out, wouldn't you say, you guys have been there. Tell us about this. You know, is that a good place? Is this a good place? I mean, wouldn't that be the natural thing for us to do? How well do you suppose Caleb and Joshua remember the land after 40 years?
Probably dreamt about it every night.
Yeah.
We could be living there now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, did their opinions count for more than the opinions of the other people because they had been there?
Should.
Well, finally, after 40 years of wandering the wilderness, having survived the terrible apostasy at Baal Peor, which you can read about, Joshua and Caleb, Moses having died, crossed the Jordan along with their families and relatives and entered the land of Canaan. The next 5 to 7 years were filled with almost constant battles as they worked on driving out or destroying the people living there. After a period of fighting was more or less over, Caleb came to Joshua and asked to be given the piece of property that God had promised him. At 85 years of age, Caleb was not afraid of those giants. Why not?
He has God on his side.
He says, I'm not the one who's fighting the battle out here. I know who's in charge here. God is on my side. Shouldn't it have been very clear to every warrior in Israel by that time that when God was on their side, they were invincible, while when God was not on their side, they couldn't win anything? You'd have thought they would have figured that out, right? Was Caleb then absolutely convinced that God would fight on his side?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What about us today? Think about us in comparison to the days of Caleb and Joshua. How many mighty miracles of God have we seen with our own eyes? Does it require greater faith to live in our world today than it did in their day? Go ahead.
What happened when Moses came back that Caleb's eyes were opened and he goes...
When he came back to Israel? Came back to Egypt?
Yes.
Well, of course, it was the plagues. The whole situation changed.
But Caleb did. What happened to everybody else? I mean, what happened to Caleb? What did he have? He had something there already.
Why did he trust completely in God and everybody, nobody else seemed to?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good question.
Well, you know, today we don't have the pillar of fire at night. We don't have the manna. Caleb's body was as strong after 40 years as it was when he went in as a spy. Do we have as many miracles today that give us this trust in God?
Well, look at Caleb's story. Look a little bit more. Let's read another. This time, turn to Joshua 14. Joshua 14, starting with verse 6. And again, I'm reading from my Good News Bible. One day, some people from the tribe of Judah came to Joshua at Gilgal. One of them, Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, now this is the same guy who was a spy, you know what the Lord said in Kadesh Barnea about you and me to Moses, the man of God. I was 40 years old when the Lord's servant Moses sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out this land. I brought an honest report back to him. The man who went with me, however, made our people afraid, but I faithfully obeyed the Lord my God. Because I did, Moses promised me that my children and I would certainly receive as our possession the land which I walked over. But now look, it has been 45 years since the Lord said that to Moses. That was when Israel was going through the desert, and the Lord, as he promised, has kept me alive ever since. Look at me, I'm an 85 years old, and I'm just as strong today as I was when Moses sent me out. How many 85-year-olds can say that? I am still strong enough for war or for anything else. Now then, give me the hill country that the Lord had promised me on that day when my men and I reported. We told you then that the race of giants called the Anakim were there in large walled cities. Maybe the Lord will be with me and I will drive them out, just as the Lord said. Did he seem to have any question about it?
He sounds like he was pretty strong and witty.
Enough to say, maybe so. Let's go.
Joshua blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and gave him the city of Hebron as his possession. And here's a city down there, big, high, tall walls, filled with giants. And he says, oh, you and your family can take it. I mean, think about it. Hebron still belongs to the descendants of Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, because he faithfully obeyed the Lord, the God of Israel. Before this, Hebron was called the Sea of Arba. Arba had been the greatest of Anakim. There was now peace in the land.
It'd be interesting to know how he actually got it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it would.
It would be very interesting.
Did he get it?
Yep, absolutely got it.
Did the bees and the...
chase them out, the hornets?
Chase them out, and the hornets.
Yeah. The giants may have seen that cloud out there and respected it more than...
Did he go into a vacated city?
No.
Did he have to shed blood to get it?
We're not told exactly what happened in the battle for Hebron, only that God gave the city and the surrounding territory to Caleb. And it just says that in so many words. Judges 15. Look at that for a second. Judges 15, 13 to 15. Actually, I'm sorry. I think I've got the wrong text here in my...
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, skip that one. But anyway, it does say that God gave it to him. I think it's probably supposed to be Joshua 15. Let's look at that for a second.
15:14 says Caleb drove out
from
there.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I got this supposed to be Joshua. As the Lord commanded Joshua, part of the territory of Judah, this is Joshua 15, starting with verse 13. As the Lord commanded Joshua, part of the territory of Judah was given to Caleb, son of Jephunneh, from the tribe of Judah. He received Hebron, the city belonging to Arba, father of Anak. Caleb drove the descendants of Anak out of the city, the clans of Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. From there he went to attack the people living in Debir. This city used to be called Kiriath Sefer. Caleb said, I will give my daughter, Aksa, in marriage to the man who succeeds in capturing Kiriath Sefer. Othniel, the son of Caleb's brother Kenaz, captured the city, so Caleb gave him his daughter, Aksa, in marriage. That's one way to get the job done.
Yeah.
Barter off a daughter, huh? On the wedding day, Othniel urged her to ask her father for a field. She got down from her donkey, and Caleb asked her what she wanted. She answered, I want some pools of water. The land you've given me is in the dry country, and this was very dry country, at least today it is. So Caleb gave her the upper and lower springs. Now here's a man who has just put his life on the line to conquer this territory. And when his daughter asks for some, and what does he know about this? When he gives his territory to his daughter, what's going to happen to it? It
becomes the husband's.
It becomes the property of his husband. Now, they were relatives, it's true, but he loses, his family line loses it. So here's Caleb, very generous to his dying day. Well, not only that, that's not the end of the story. Look at Judges 1. starting with verse 18. Judges 1, starting with verse 18. The Lord helped the people of Judah, and they took possession of the hill country. But they did not capture Gaza, Ashkelon, or Ekron with their surrounding territories. These people living along the coast had iron chariots, and so the people of Judah were not able to drive them out. As Moses had commanded, Hebron was given to Caleb, who drove out of the city the three clans descended from Anak. But the people of the tribe of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites living in Jerusalem, and the Jebusites have continued to live there with the people of Benjamin ever since. And if we had time to go through Judges 1, 2, and 3, we would find out that there were whole tribes that hardly were able to conquer any of the territory that had been assigned them because they just didn't seem to have the faith or the wherewithal to do it. But here's Caleb and his family with some help, I'm sure, from the tribe of Judah, and they just conquer their territory.
Not to mention the help of God.
Not to mention the help of God. What are we supposed to learn from that? That sure?
Well, if you have God on your side, things are going to just proceed and put one foot in front of the other and let God open the gates before you.
Don't you think the other people that went up there had God on their side?
What about the whole tribe of Dan, for example, who basically never conquered any land until you get to the very end of Judges and they finally conquered one city?
Did they believe in God? Did they put one foot in front of the other and even try?
I don't know.
Or did they just sit there and say, I can't do it, I can't?
Probably.
They probably intermarried.
Yep.
Then couldn't.
Mm-hmm. And what in Caleb's background bringing up caused him to have all this faith in God when all the others had seen everything else, had seen what Caleb has seen, but Caleb learned and started to trust and really started to experiment with God and say, I am going to step out and do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting to notice that, and we go back to Genesis 49, that Judah, the tribe of Judah, was supposed to be the kingly tribe. The kings were supposed to come from that tribe. Do we know who the ancestors of David were? Quite a few of them. Was Caleb a member of that group? He was from the tribe of Judah.
Was he from the tribe of Judah?
Mm-hmm. He was the leading man from the tribe of Judah that was chosen by Moses to become a spy.
And Jesus came from the tribe of Judah.
And Jesus came from the tribe of Judah.
So the tribe of Judah had something special.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that Othniel, Caleb's nephew who married his daughter, was the first judge of Israel. Unless you count Samuel before that. I mean, Samuel came a long time later, I'm sorry. He was the first judge of the tribe of Israel. And he took charge. And apparently did a good job, and it says the country was at peace for 40 years under his rulership.
So this Othniel, like Caleb, had trust in God.
Yep.
And he was a nephew of Caleb.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some other characters. I'm just filling in a little bit of the story as we're running out of time. You remember the story of David when he was running away from Saul, as it got toward the end of his experience, he had like 400 people that were staying with him, and they finally decided the only safe thing was for them to move down out of the territory that was close to Saul anyway, and live in a small city by the name of Ziklag. Mm-hmm. Well, there's some hint that Ziklag was a part of this territory that Caleb had won, and now it had been reconquered by the Philistines. And so now it was Philistine territory. But it was on that border between Judah and the Philistines. And here was David. It was a refuge for him. There's an interesting story about that. If we had time, we would go and discuss it. It's in 1 Samuel 30, verses 17 to 20.
So if you honor God, God will allow you to help other people that are serving him.
Yep. And in 1 Samuel 25, we don't have time to, well, maybe we have time to just look at a couple of verses there. 1 Samuel 25, verses 2, and we'll start with verse 1. After this, David went to the wilderness of Paran. There was a man of the clan of Caleb named Nabal, who was from the town of Maon and who owned land near the town of Carmel. He was a very rich man, the owner of 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. His wife Abigail was beautiful and intelligent, but he was a mean, bad-tempered man. Nabal was shearing his sheep at Carmel, and David, who was in the wilderness, heard about it, so he sent 10 young men with orders to go to Carmel, find Nabal, and give him his greetings. And we don't have time to go through all the story, but this man was a very bad guy, and even though he was descended from Caleb, he was a pretty disreputable character, and he ended up dying of a fit. And what did David do? Married his wife. Yeah. Well, now, pulling things together. Did the 10 spies feel that all the evidence was stacked against them? Sure. Why do you suppose they came with that bad report? Where they were so certain that the facts, you know, look at those giants, look at the walled cities, da-da-da. Were they so certain that the facts were against them that it really didn't matter whether God helped them or not?
Did they want God just to do a miracle and make all the people just fall down so they could just walk across them like they did the Red Sea?
I don't think they thought God could do it.
I think they forgot all about God.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they took one look at that giant and said, and their knees just quivered.
Grasshoppers.
Grasshoppers, that's right.
The grasshopper complex.
There you go.
Yeah. Do we ever get the grasshopper complex in our day?
Yeah.
How often, when we should speak up on God's behalf, do we act like grasshoppers? Oh, no, I can't talk about God. I mean, look at all these big people out here, and they're more important than me, and they got more education, and they got this, and they got that. And
not trusting that God will put the words in your mouth.
Mm-hmm. Does God have the ability to take charge and help us out when we need it? Mm-hmm. Well, how often in our day are we bombarded with facts on such ideas as the theory of evolution? Do we allow ourselves to be swept away by these facts? How can we learn to clearly distinguish between the hard data, the real facts, and people's interpretation of those facts? And how can we learn to trust in God as Caleb and Joshua did so that we will cross that heavenly Jordan into the heavenly Canaan? See you again next week.